What is technological deflation? And more importantly, how can entrepreneurs harness it and benefit from it to build beautiful businesses? Jeff Booth tells us.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast. Entrepreneurs are economic heroes. They improve others' lives with preferred products and services, innovation, and value. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one by building a beautiful business. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. There are some macro trends that it's beneficial for entrepreneurs to think about. The macro trend we are discussing today is technological deflation. By that, we mean the ability of businesses, through the application of technology, to deliver more satisfaction and facilitate more value for customers at faster speeds and lower cost. It's becoming fundamental. As Jeff Bezos puts it, no one's going to ask me, "Hey Jeff, can you send me lower quality stuff more slowly and raise the prices?" What are the implications for entrepreneurial businesses? We'll explore that today, but to orient yourself, think of these. Technological change is advancing faster and faster across all parts of business and all parts of personal life. It's all pervasive. That means the tools for technological revolution are available to every entrepreneur, which means in turn that every customer will come to expect and demand the convenience and performance of technology in all parts of their life, and every business you think of as competitive to you will be striving to meet their demand. Therefore, your business model must incorporate technology, continuous change and improvement, lower costs, faster speeds, and more convenience as table stakes. Start there and then advance. We're going to find out two more fundamentals today. One is that change is exponential, not linear. And there is a way to harness that exponential, which is to combine multiple revolutionary technologies. You'll find the result is not additive, it's multiplicative. The second is that there is an underlying secret that you can utilize to create a distinctive offering to the customer, and that is the organization of information flow. Information is almost infinite and mostly free, but you can be selective with this cornucopia of information, and what you select, what you uniquely present to the customer, can be the basis of comparative advantage. Brands are still strongly advantaged economic concepts, except now they're built differently. They're built with information flow. Establishing a position on the front page of a Google search replaces establishing a position as a top advertising spender in your category. A guide through these new frontiers today is Jeff Booth. Jeff built a very successful digital information flow business in a very basic industry, the building industry, bringing more and better products faster at lower cost to building contractors through technology. He is now an investor guiding many similar businesses through the exponential growth corridors of the technological revolution. He's also an author of a book called The Price of Tomorrow, which is a clear-eyed explanation of technological deflation. He's going to help us an awful lot with both his experience and his vision. Jeff, welcome to Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Thanks for having me, Hunter.
You'll be a super guest because you're an entrepreneur, a very successful entrepreneur. We'll ask you some questions about that. And you also became an author of a book called The Price of Tomorrow, which is about deflation and how deflation is key to an abundant future. So we'll try and weave in some conversation about that, Jeff. You're talking to a bunch of people who are friendly towards deflation. We think it should be the norm. We think that your dollar should buy more every year rather than less. And a lot of us think that we can point to a time in U.S. history when it was the case. Some economists point to the years from the Civil War to about 1900. So it's a good thing. But you pointed out in the book that most people are scared of inflation. Why do you think that is?
Well, so human progress, innovation is deflationary in nature, unless you're creating massive new industries, right? Because you're actually, that innovation, whether it's in tech or otherwise, reduces the human labor component. So that innovation frees our time. And so a natural order of things is deflation. And today, with how fast technology is moving, that deflation or that efficiency gained is staggering. It would blow people's minds how fast technology is moving and what's happening to efficiency, which means deflation should be moving exponentially through society. And what that should mean is that we should be freeing our time at that same rate. We should have more time, and the labor component should go down. It's not happening because we've created a system that requires inflation to work. And that system today is really a Ponzi scheme. It's more and more debt, lower and lower interest rates, negative interest rates, to print more money, to try to drive inflation against the natural order of things. And so you could, that lens that's happening today, you could look through all the second order effects, wealth inequality, people rising up on the streets, people not being able to pay for food, housing, and everything else. All of those things all around the globe are predictable second order consequences of kind of what I would call it is the great fight of our time, the natural force of technology bringing efficiency, which should free our time, against monetary easing, trying to do the opposite.
Well, can we separate the inflationary activities of the monetarists and the Federal Reserve and so on from the implication of deflation for entrepreneurs? I recall from your book, one way to illustrate what you just said about technology is packing more and more customer value into goods and services at a lower and lower cost, or even just at the same dollar cost, you get more services and more value. And you use the iPhone as an example. Every cycle, it packs in more features, maps and search and the App Store and a compass and a recording device and a camera and now streaming TV and gaming and so on. Is that how the entrepreneur should think of it? I've got to pack more and more quality and services and benefits into what I provide to the customer at the same price or a lower price?
Yes, simply. I would say an entrepreneur can gain tremendous leverage in an economy like this and what's happening with technology if they understand how fast technology is moving and where value comes from. Okay, and I'll give you an example first to kind of frame this because I think it's critically important. So, from my book, I use that paper folding exercise. And if you fold a piece of paper on itself, up 50 times, that piece of paper would reach the sun. And I've asked that question to tens of thousands of people around the world, and 99.9% of people say it's going to be about 2 inches on fold 50. And so what that says is that all human beings misunderstand exponential. And we have exponential growth in technology moving into all parts of industry. It's a base layer of everything today. And so if you didn't first get that, by the way, if you've heard the question before, you'll think you know exponentials, but the evidence says otherwise, that we do really badly there. But if you think in exponentials over our economy, this is what's happening. So, and the entrepreneurial ride. So early on, that piece of paper, that fold looks like nothing. So the first fold, the second fold, the third fold, it looks like nothing. And what happens in technology is people way overestimate how much that's going to change the world. And there's this hype cycle that comes in, and Gartner has done a good job of saying what the Gartner hype cycle is, that kind of overestimates that technology. And then there's a huge letdown because people think, wow, this is nothing. But it keeps folding, it keeps doubling underneath. It keeps moving at that rate, and by the time you get into the big folds, it's unbelievable how much you miss it the other way. So how fast things move the other way. But technology doesn't, so business value doesn't come typically from one type of technology. It comes from putting two or three different technologies together. It comes from the orthogonal look of what's happening. And so if you use AI as an example, an AI company, just an AI company, is not very valuable. It has to do something. And so yeah, I'll use another example. Elon Musk, effectively what he does is he forecasts the exponential. He promises something that is impossible when he promises it and forecasts the exponential. And he actually charges you for it when he forecasts it, and he delivers it 2 years later on the exponential. It also creates some risk, because he might be just off. But the technology keeps solving those problems, and the push against technology solves those problems, and you move to those places earlier than anyone else. So for entrepreneurs, and this is where I have a hard time, because my book talks about what it is at a macro level, what everybody's facing. But for entrepreneurs right now, there are crazy opportunities, because we're seeing tech that we've never seen before. And people don't understand how fast it's moving.
So let's explore some examples of that. I have a low-tech one in mind. One of our partners in the project that we're working on is a fellow called Bob Luddy, who has been a conventional entrepreneur in the sense that he started his own business from scratch in the restaurant ventilation system, fire suppression and ventilation, a very standard metal bending kind of industry and assembling and so on like that. But he has this strategy, which is to price below the market and then constantly pack more and more value into his offering. And today he's starting to do that with technology. So you can put monitoring technology into those ventilation systems, which feeds data back to the center, which allows him to learn about how the system works and improve it at great speeds. That feels like kind of exponential, and a little bit about what you're talking about. Is that an example? And maybe you have some others.
It's a small example, and it's exactly the right thing. And this is what I kind of talk about in the book. No CEO puts in technology to be able to make their prices go up or their value go down. Right. So if you add up what we're capable of, what the companies I'm involved in that are capable of and what they're doing, they're actually reducing costs and increasing value all the time. So the entrepreneur that you just talked about is doing his job and remember, an entrepreneur only wins if they deliver value and pretty amazing value to customers. And that is deflationary, and that's innovation that is driving that deflation. So he is doing that. What's happening though, kind of at a macro picture of what he's doing, is if you think about the data capture that he's trying to gather on just his units, compared to the data capture that is being gathered by the platforms, it's a staggering difference. Mm-hmm. And so. To get to artificial intelligence, you have to have massive data capture, and you have to have essentially information moving all the time, more and more data and more signals to drive deep learning and algorithms to be able to effectively make better decisions faster. So the person who aggregates the most data, typically the best algorithm wins, and the best algorithm is derived out of the most data. There is no second best algorithm. That's why Amazon looks like Amazon today. That's why Google looks like Google today. All of these platforms are really data collection mm-hmm. platforms driven by AI.
So when you said that we should think about the speed at which this technological deflation is happening, and you use the phrase where value comes from, is that what you're referring to, that value comes from the information flow?
Exactly. Well, value looks different in a new world. Today, I'll give you a couple of examples. First, one looking backwards. Blockbuster thought their value came from the retail store network, where you drove to a store, right? And they had 9,000 stores, and everybody accepted that value, and it was a big business. And when technology changed the rules to make download speeds happen in an instant, rather than, you remember, what download speeds were before. Then Netflix immediately had an advantage, a structural advantage that nothing Blockbuster could do could change that the structural advantage. The value came from a different place. And so all the stores became a noose hanging around their neck. And what they did, and it's pretty common, most people do it to protect their industry, is they added candy aisles to their stores, right? And we laugh at that, right? Like, oh yeah, that's going to start because, and everybody in Blockbuster says, but people want the convenience of candy while they're, and popcorn while they're watching a movie, unaware that a structural shift has happened and value comes from somewhere else. So that's one looking back. There's thousands of examples looking backwards, but looking forward, what is different? Let's use education. And I'll use right now, technology available right now. And by the way, probably for a lot of your listeners, education is free today. Like everybody says, university education's gone through the roof or whatever. Mm-hmm. You could learn any subject at any rate you want, all the way up to kind of master's level and everything else for free. The information's sitting there, right? It's abundant. Yeah. It's your time you're choosing to get that degree that is not free, and your time is putting that you're choosing because most people don't have the dedication to commit to finding that information. But let's forget free and let's say how do we aggregate that information and do something different? Effectively today, you could take so what is a university? What is a college? It's a collection of people. Hopefully really great educators that you have to go to, like the Blockbuster store, to be able to get value out of. And so it's a real estate play and everything else. And the better the teachers and the better the brand, the more ability they can attract other teachers and you to pay more for school. So now let's look at that through a technology lens. So it's really the information that the teacher gives you and teaches you that is of the value, right? And that information could be shared worldwide for pennies rather than what's happening today. So if you now play that forward, you could hire the best educators. You could put an online course together where virtual reality is moving. Is it'll make Zoom feel like nothing, right? It'll feel like it's a real experience. Mm-hmm. And where artificial intelligence is already moving, because most of the questions from students are the same questions. And so what you could actually do right now with existing technology at scale is you could individualize those lessons and have a digital teacher that looks like the real teacher that the student would have no idea. Answering the questions and have individual learning with essentially technology that's here today. And where that technology is moving to is going to change the game a staggering amount. So then the advantage, a digital company like that doesn't have to rely on the cost structure of everything else that a university has. They can rely on a totally different cost structure like Netflix that changes the rules completely. And because they can scale that worldwide for pennies instead of having people fly to the school and live at the school, they can also afford the best teachers. So an example, those are a couple of examples of where value comes from in a different way. And what I'd say for entrepreneurs, especially startup entrepreneurs, and I know you deal a lot there, and you probably mm-hmm. use this filter as well. If you don't have a 10x advantage to the existing market or structure, it's really difficult to break through because of the noise today. So if it was only a little bit of an advantage to the existing market, what ends up happening is if the big guys crowd you out, right? Or they change their business before you get there and they erode your advantage. So I look for entrepreneurs that are creating at least a 10 times value difference to market.
Yeah, and I'm I think I'm beginning to get a little bit of a sense of this exponential idea, at least in the sense that you talked about combining multiple technologies. So we talked about AI plus VR plus an information flow, you know, all the information for learning is available on the internet that you can access it, plus, I should say, multiplied by maybe the best teacher. So I could see that that's a multiplicative effect of multiple technologies. Is that?
That's exactly what I'm saying. And that's actually where why the value comes from that, because entrepreneurs are really good at looking across different technologies, putting them together and saying, where does value come from? Whereas most people are in their silos. So universities is what we just talked about. You'll have an AI department, you'll have a deep learning department, you'll have a quantum department, you'll have a whole bunch of different departments, all specialists. And same thing in business. Like if you use that Blockbuster example, all of the people hired in Blockbuster make the machine, the 9,000 stores, really efficient. But what they don't see is the two different technologies or whatever coming together to create a different type of business and value for customers. And all of that effectively siloing, right, almost makes you blind to what can happen with how fast technology is moving. So now put those two things together. Your audience, are very likely to underestimate how fast technology is moving across every different field. And we're likely to silo into our own business and not see that. So now put those things together and you realize, wow, if you could take your mind out of your silo and see what's happening in different silos and put some of those things together, you can create incredible value.
Yeah, and one of the ways that silos are perpetuated, we think, is through business schools talking about industries and market share and positioning and those kinds of things. The industry had boundaries, and that's no longer the case. So you use the Elon Musk example, and people might say he's in the automotive industry, but he's not. He's in the battery area and in software and in energy and all kinds of things. There's no such thing as an industry anymore, I don't think. It's what you say. It's a combination of technologies. Is that a good way
to... What did he do to be able to break through that? He had to forecast the exponential in a number of different industries, because if he didn't do it on batteries for the cars, then the cars wouldn't be priced effectively and provide that advantage. If he didn't do it on the technology to underneath that and the software systems, it wouldn't look like it does today. So he's forecasting the exponentials on a number of different industries to be able to create value. He did the same thing in rockets.
And is this accessible, this combination of technologies, accessible to any entrepreneur? You can download it from the internet. You can buy computing power from AWS. Is that accurate? It's available to anybody?
Information free. Your ability to go gather that information, find the right people in your network, not get caught in the silos, look deeper, question everything, real curiosity is a driver. Your time is really important, but the information is free. It's available to everybody.
So here's one idea in that area that's been bothering me a little bit. I come out of the branding area, Jeff, and we used to invest money in advertising and packaging design and PR and those kinds of things to create brands, which are really an inflationary device, right? I'm trying to achieve a premium price without necessarily adding any real value, maybe image value and that kind of thing. Is that idea dead now, the branding idea?
No, it's not at all, because and I often think about, so if you think about what the internet was supposed to be, right, it was supposed to be the great equalizer, right? So it would give everybody this power and everyone would have the same power. But because of what you just said, that information consolidates on platforms. And it's because we can't handle that information overload, so we trust Google or Amazon to do it for us, right? So And so you couldn't, Google indexes over 130 trillion websites. How many times do you go past page one?
Right. Almost never.
And you know this because it's in the book, but I talk about how platforms create their value, what they do to create their value from network effects and understanding the data flows and where the value comes from. But from your branding idea, brands still matter a lot. It's just you build the brands differently. So you have Google that is probably one of the biggest brands today that doesn't spend any on advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so the brand value is created differently today than it used to be, or it needs to be created differently. It's actually probably one of the reasons why I talk about the 10X, what you need in a company is a 10X advantage, because you have to have that sort of compelling structural advantage to beat the brand or distribution power.
Are there any categories where deflation won't be the norm, or is this a universal consideration?
So when people look at this thesis and everything else, I don't think they're connecting dots on all sides. So how did I come to this? I'm seeing all these technology companies. I'm involved in some. One of my technology companies last year was doing $300,000 a month. It's now doing $5 million. And so how did I see this? I'm sitting at the front edge of all these technology companies and watching what's happening. And I'm even in front of those, I'm inside some of the universities and different things, seeing where technology is moving, how fast it's moving across society. And so what that means is that efficiency should be moving across society. We should see reduced price in everything. And so when I followed that logic, so why isn't that happening? And then I looked at the monetary side of it and I realized, okay, we have $250 trillion of debt for an $80 trillion global economy. That's bad, but maybe over time the debt could be repaid with growth. But then when you look deeper, $185 trillion of that debt came over the last 20 years. And what it says is it's masking. So it's trying to make prices go up against an inflationary, or against a massively exponentially deflationary technology. And so on the other side of the coin, you have to drive exponential money printing to be able to try to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's looking backwards. Because people haven't seen this before and it's changing so fast, they won't realize what's happening. So people say, well, my university goes up in price, my food goes up in price, my housing goes up in price. And I ask them, what would your house price cost without $185 trillion of stimulus in the last 20 years? And only then can they say, oh my God, it's just an entire Ponzi scheme. Right? Mm-hmm. The entire thing is built on you have to create more money at an exponential scale to stop the thing that could be giving abundance to humanity really fast. And it becomes crazy, but we're caught in that loop. And so as entrepreneurs, we're all caught in that loop. As individuals, we're all caught in that loop. And most people aren't talking about what's the driver of it all. They're talking about the consequence. They're, instead of looking at the roots, they're looking at the branches.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4EPod. That's MISES.org/E4EPod and click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
Yeah, a friend of mine, a fellow called Kartik Gada, has tried to calculate this technological deflation at the macro level. He puts it around 3% right now. And he said it'll just get higher because, as you say, technology is going to be a bigger and bigger part of the economy. And he said he'd have to put $100 trillion of QE or money printing into the economy in the next decade to offset that. So
he's right. He's like, the number is so staggering. It would blow people's minds what that number is. And it has to be exponential because you have exponential technology moving across society.
You said in the book, Jeff, that the transition from inflation to deflation has the potential to be difficult and ugly. And we're talking at the macro level, I think, here, and because we've just talked about the benefits at the micro level, the entrepreneurial level. Why is it going to be ugly?
Because that reset, that money. So there's only two ways out of this right now, and I wish there was. COVID actually accelerated the trend. And if you think about from what we're talking about, so every entrepreneur that's listening to this, and myself too, what I realize is in this world, I need to deliver value faster. And the way to deliver value faster is more technology, right? So in effect, you're actually speeding up that, because otherwise the only way you can compete is to get handouts from the state. Mm-hmm. There is no free market anymore. So the governments have removed the free market, and all the money printing is just going up to hold asset prices high and businesses from failing that would have otherwise failed. But if they stop that from happening, so if you just said, okay, let's let natural course happen today and no more money printing, here's what would happen. You would have a deflationary depression. Asset prices, all asset prices, would fall by about 90%, 85, 90%. Banks would fail. All banks would fail because the money isn't there. There's no money. It's based on a credit system, and that deflationary depression would the real cost of the money, because the deflation would make the real debt explode in cost. So it would be reset, and it would be a wipeout of the entire financial system globally. So I suspect nobody on their watch is going to allow that to happen. So that's option number one, unfortunately. Option number two is just as bad, and it turns into essentially more control by government, higher pushing prices higher and higher and higher. Asset owners win out of that inflation. But if you think about it, that inflation is wage deflation. Right. If you're trying to drive inflation, what you're saying for people on wages is, I'm giving you less money. And people don't look at that. They think, oh, we need inflation, but they don't realize they're picking the pocket of all of the people that don't have assets. And as that moves into hyperinflation, kind of all and more government control, what's the value of money anymore? And so you're going to see currency after currency get wiped out through hyperinflation, I expect, at some point. And due to what your friend said, the printing to make that happen is going to have to be staggering, but I suspect that that's what they're going to do. Governments, not just US, not Canada, everywhere. And that's what so you're going to have these currencies failing country after country after country. And unfortunately, that's where we are on this cycle. And there's only two ways to reset it. One of the pick a path, and both of those paths are really painful for society.
In the transition.
But here's the thing, and you know, I talked about this quite a bit in the book. In the transition, what you're seeing right now all over the world is, very few people are talking what I'm talking about, right? What they're talking about is, we need more stimulus. What they're talking about is, it's the Republicans' fault. It's the government's fault. It's socialism mm-hmm. for the rich. It's socialism for the poor. You have this divide of society driving in, and people are not even looking through empathy on the other side. They actually believe they're right. And you can't measure a system by an independent variable in the system. And so this system, what I said, the technology, how fast it's moving against an inflationary monetary policy, period, full stop, will not work. It cannot work because the technology is moving so fast. I wish it could. I wish I could wave a magic wand and tell you what I'm saying isn't true. But because nobody's saying this, what's happening is instead they're dividing society. And neighbor against neighbor, and how dare you, as everybody fights for their own piece of that share. And what's really happening under it, they're worried about the future. Right? That's why they're fighting. But they're all fighting on top of a system that cannot work. It's like fighting in Blockbuster executives about putting candy aisles in the stores. The system cannot functionally work with what we're seeing. So we need to, on the other side of this, there will be, here, maybe this is best way, a technology moving and providing this much value or efficiency and needs a deflationary currency. It's a requirement, because any other type of policy is giving government control to choose who wins.
So I wonder if technology can solve this problem, Jeff. And this is a very partially thought out idea, but what if technology takes that role? Let's put it in the vernacular of creating a universal basic income. So Amazon and Google and all of the others somehow generate a digital currency that they make available to everyone as a result of their digital businesses. They're kind of giving part of it back, and they solve that problem because they put this digital currency straight into the hands of consumers. Is there anything there? Technology can solve the problem, not government.
No, control by a different means. So giving control. So just so you know, if you taxed all of those companies that you just talked about at 100%, 200%, 500%, they don't have enough money or to be able to pay what the problem is. So there's going to be a reset. That why governments want inflation is because what they're really telling you is, I need the value of the currency to go down. I need to drive inflation so I can pay back the debt. And so they will be eventually successful, but it'll create then it'll move into hyperinflation. But essentially, the value of your currency is eroded. And in that storm, so I believe, and if people look deeply at Bitcoin right now, why Bitcoin? And when I say it'll sound like I'm a massive, because Bitcoin has a whole bunch of people that are, that I would say are over the top Bitcoin promoters. Mm-hmm. But if you look underneath that, what people are really saying, who've done the work and gone down the rabbit hole on what this is, I actually believe Bitcoin is a must in anybody's portfolio right now, because it's a lifeboat to what's coming in the storms that are coming. More than that, I actually believe that Bitcoin might be the only way to transition peacefully to what's coming. I think eventually governments are going to have to peg their currencies to Bitcoin.
And Bitcoin would qualify as what you called a deflationary currency?
It's a deflation. It avoids manipulation. You cannot manipulate it. And essentially the people are in control. There is no way to change that because of the way that it operates. Now, for your listeners, go deeper, understand it more. There's lots of great resources on Twitter to be able to find that. But I do believe that that's actually the, because when I wrote the book, I actually thought that governments could get together and come up with something. I thought that was a very low probability, but it was still a chance. Today, to make a currency that actually operated like Bitcoin, right? That governments couldn't manipulate. Now I don't think there's a chance anymore because COVID's accelerated all the trends, and governments are each one's trying to get their own digital currency to do exactly what we're talking about, more control over citizens.
So Jeff, let's flip the telescope around a little bit and think from the consumer's point of view. In our economics, we talk about consumer sovereignty, that the consumer ultimately, by buying or not buying and how they participate, shapes the economy and shapes firms and shapes products and services. If they buy more Teslas and fewer Volkswagens, then we get more Teslas and Teslas get better and better, and Volkswagen might leave the market. So the consumer has the power in the marketplace. And I wonder if that's still going to be the case in this future of digital deflation that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and I think a free market solves all of this, right? So what does an entrepreneur do? They only win when they create value for the consumer, right? And so they try to create what we talked about before, that 10x type of value for the consumer, and they win when the consumer is happy and uses their services or product. And so that free market does solve all of this, and it brings prices lower and lower. So anything else is actually a control, is pushing more control to the state. And what I would say is there's two ways to organize society. One, control, and two is a free market. And if you're saying that the state should control, be careful of that, because what that means is always throughout history that moves to control through the biggest dictator. And so a free market isn't perfect; it needs checks and balances and everything else. But because what ends up happening is entrepreneurs trying to deliver value to you are a better gauge of what should happen in a market. It's a million different experiments in the market that are testing, or that are testing against you, what has value, instead of pushing that value to the state or control of government. And so on the other side of that, if you looked at what is happening in government, is what it's saying is, I can choose better, right? And so today, if you look at through that lens, so today prices shouldn't be anywhere where they are need to be today, because and they're only that high because government is choosing to protect industries from failing. So use that example on how much money has gone into the market, that 185 trillion that I said around the world for the use for housing market means, and that's debt. So that means that housing is that artificially priced high. And if it fails, banks fail. So governments are pushing more money to keep from prices going up in housing. And at the same time, what's happening is on the other side of that coin, because people can't pay the rents anymore, those people are coming to government and saying, I need money to pay me for the artificially high prices that you created in the first place. Mm-hmm. So all of those things, and through that lens, more and more people on both sides of this aisle, socialism for the rich or socialism for the poor, are actually going to government to try to get more money the government doesn't have, because the government money comes from you in taxes. There are businesses, the thriving businesses. So more money the government doesn't have to solve the problem the government created in the first place. Seems kind of ironic. A free market solves that, and a free market brings prices down more and more over time. That innovation is shared broadly with society.
Well, Jeff, this is pretty exciting, I think, because despite the transition issues, you're confirming a belief in free market economics. You're pointing to inspirational opportunities for entrepreneurs. There's hopefully a good outcome for consumers. We get more value. You've confirmed our thoughts about value theory. You just apply them in a very futuristic, insightful way, and we've learned a lot from you. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Hunter. It's a pleasure.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.